about the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity.
Come. Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of the Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
fighting. Right now, right now.
Now the time to do the right thing.
Yes, yes, let's do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And you heard a little bit more of the intro music because we are having a bit of some technical difficulties with our guest. So not to worry. He's in the studio, so we are just going to move on. So thank you for being with us today. It is a nasty day outside, and I know St. Louisans are known for not driving very well in inclement weather, so be safe out there. And if you're in the car listening to us, stay tuned for this hour because we are going to unpack a number of things. This is the place, Voices from the Battlefield, of folks who are on the battlefield and they are fighting for things. They're fighting against things. And the person that we have today is a person who's actually been on the battlefield for a very long time, and I'm talking about none other than Sylvester Brown. And Sylvester Brown may not be known to a lot of people, but for those of us in the movement for democracy and racial justice, he's been there amplifying not just our voices, but voices from the community. And those are the kind of griots that we really, really need, particularly in St. Louis, and particularly at this time when our very existence is at stake in terms of our history, our culture, and what people think about our legacy here in America. So I want to welcome Sylvester Brown to Voices from the Battlefield.
Well, thank you, Jamal. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for that gracious welcome.
Yes, but I actually want you to talk a little bit about your background, and I sure. say that because particularly for young people, I always tell them the way you start off is not the way you have to end up.
Right.
And I'm just even talking about your career. I know you had humble beginnings in Pruitt-Igoe,
right.
but also whoever, I mean, did you ever think you were going to be a writer? So we'll get to that in a minute. So talk a little bit about your childhood in Pruitt-Igoe, okay. but I also want you to touch upon the infamous poisoning of that community, which a documentary has been done on both Pruitt-Igoe
right.
that you were in,
mm-hmm.
and as well as the poisoning by our U.S. government.
Right.
So talk about the Sylvester Brown growing up in Pruitt-Igoe.
Yeah, you know, it's even to me, it's been a strange journey. Moved into Pruitt-Igoe. I was born in DeVille, but I moved into Pruitt-Igoe when I was around, I don't know, maybe 6, 7 years old. Our saving grace was the fact that we were Jehovah's Witnesses. We were raised as Jehovah's Witnesses. And so at a very early age, I learned how to read. I mean, I don't know if you know about the religion, but we had meetings and studies almost 7 days a week. So I learned how to read, learned how to write. I learned how to debate. I learned how to research to back up my spiritual arguments with scripture. So I was trained for all that, you know, at an early age. I was a horrible student. I think basically because I was creative. I was artistic. I used to draw as a kid, draw cartoons and have my own comic strips and all that stuff. But I was not a very good student because I really couldn't pay attention. And at that time, with 30 to 40 kids in the classroom, teacher didn't have time to point me out and say, hey, this kid has a special gift or not. You know, mm-hmm. he made the grade.
Absolutely.
So for a long time, I thought I was a failure at school. I dropped out of high school to go to work. But like I said, we were impoverished. My father was a chronic alcoholic. My mother was a saint, a hero. She was everything to us. We had 11 kids in the family. And somehow, I don't know how, she managed to do everything to keep us in school, to keep us well-dressed, to keep us well-fed. She worked sometimes 2-3 jobs, and we were on public assistance. So she was and will always be my hero. So anyway, dropped out of school. I went to work for the Cleve Gas Company. And it's ironic that I knew absolutely nothing about black history. You know, as a young black man growing up.
That's not ironic or unusual.
Yeah. Well, I guess I was in the norm. Because growing up, I knew nothing about black history. It wasn't until I was in my early 20s. I went to St. Louis Community College because a friend of mine at the Cleve Gas was going there, too. So I went there to, you know, to study commercial art. I picked up a book, the autobiography of Malcolm X. First book I had ever read that had a black hero, a black story that I could relate with. And it absolutely changed my life. I mean, I can say to you that literature, black history, absolutely changed my life. So while I was at Forest Park, I decided that no kid like me would grow up ignorant of his history. So I went to work doing art for this little bar newspaper called Trist. And I started selling ads and helping design it. Then I started writing little columns. I started writing a column about bars and restaurants. From there, I gained the knowledge to start my own newspaper, which I did in 1987, called Take Five Magazine. It was a monthly publication. I was still working at the Cleve Gas Company. But I started to be very radical at that time. I was starting to get the brothers to protest and try to hire a lawyer, because at that time they were just instituting the mandatory drug tests, mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan's thing. So
right.
I was trying to get guys to organize and fight that, because for some reason they were always testing us more and, you know, more often than others. So anyway, so I think the people at the Cleve Gas decided this Negro who has his own magazine is a danger to us. And don't get me wrong, I gave them plenty of room to fire me, mm-hmm. which they did, which made me become a full-time newspaper publisher. So for 15 years, me and my wife at the time, Victoria Anton, put out this publication. Never really made money, but garnered, you know, about 30 journalism awards.
Yeah.
And it kind of seeded me, the newspaper, us, in the black community, because we took no prisoners. I mean, we were hard hit. You know, our motto was Mother Jones Magazine,
mm-hmm.
and somewhat like the Riverfront Times. And we just did hard-hitting journalism and won all kinds of awards. And
Can I stop you there?
Sure.
Because I don't know, because it's been away for a while, and sometimes out of sight, out of mind. But for those of us who read Take Five, who were featured in Take Five, it was a excellent piece of journalism that we hadn't seen before, because both of us have worked for the St. Louis American, but that's a different kind of newspaper. They don't have the space or the reporters to do that kind of investigative reporting, which you all did. And it was just an amazing newspaper. So I was really filled with a lot of sadness to see you all go, and you remember I insisted on having a going away party for you all, Liz Brown and myself. But I just really wanted the community to appreciate the sacrifice, because like you said, they never really did make money. And so how do you still have a dream and a vision but still take care of yourself and your family?
Right.
And so therein is the conflict. But I still have the Fade to Black issue, which is the last issue.
Do you have the Last Action Hero issue?
Yes, I do. The Last Action Hero, which featured Percy Green. And in some ways, Sylvester, working for those corporations, you all have a parallel kind of thing going on, because he worked for McDonnell Douglas, he meaning Percy Green, and he was doing all this, you know, community activism, but he was still going to work, going on time and whatever, and he thought that would keep him employed. But when they started to look at these other extracurricular activities, including climbing the arch, they said, oh, Negro, you got to go. So he didn't give them any pause. They just said, this is, he's going to be a liability for us.
Well,
so,
just one thing I want to add, if not for Percy and the Action Network, the Clee Gas wouldn't have ever hired black folks, because they had a quota because of their actions to hire African Americans.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I remember I was 20 years old and the word spread in the community, the Clee Gas hired Negroes. But I didn't learn until many, many years later that that was Action's doing.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, sometimes we're in a community where things are happening and we don't fully see all the hands that are guiding us. And sometimes it's not until we get past that point where we look back and say, wow.
Yeah.
That's why that happened. Because it's not off the goodness of their heart, I can tell you that.
Two times I was fired, the Clee Gas and St. Louis Post Dispatch. People around me were saying it was the most horrible thing ever, because both of those are very good jobs, benefits, yada, yada, yada. But in retrospect, I have to humbly say that that was divine intervention. You know, the universe said, brother,
this is not for
you. Making money, this ain't you.
This is not.
In fact, it's killing you.
It's killing you.
Yes.
Crushing your spirit.
Yeah.
And talk a little about the experience at the Post-Dispatch, because that was when Greg Freeman, who was, I think at that time, their only black columnist.
Yes.
And so they opened it up and said, you know, black folks who think they can write, let's see what you got. And I remember there were some black folks that were reporters had contacted me to say, you should apply. And I'm like, I don't think so. I don't think that's my kind of a thing. And I think I'm going to be censored. I had been working at the St. Louis American, which my stuff is not censored. So I said, I don't think I need to be there. You landed that job.
I did. And it was funny, because many of the African Americans who were there weren't pleased that I got hired, because I didn't come through their ranks.
Exactly.
You know, I didn't go to journalism school. I didn't start at a newspaper and work my way through. I just came off the streets. But here's how it happened, ironically. The late Eric Vickers, and Vince Shamel, at the time, the internet was just taking off. The newspapers were struggling to survive.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of newspapers were partnering with small local newspapers. So Vince Shamel and Eric Vickers went to the Post-Dispatch and tried to convince them to partner with Take Five magazine. At the time, the publisher, Terry Egger, he couldn't see the financial benefit of that, but he fell in love with me. He liked my writing. He kept saying, why don't you just come work for us? And I'm like, no, I mean, I got my own newspaper.
Mm-hmm,
I don't want to go.
Yeah.
But he kept saying that. You need to come apply with us, work with us. Then Greg passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And Terry said, you need to apply for the job. So when the publishers say you need to apply for the job,
You got a little inside. Yeah, right.
So I applied for it, and against a whole lot of folks nationally.
Ah.
And I remember Cynthia Todd had me come in and said, we can offer you this, this, this. When can you start? And I was like, yesterday. it was the holy grail of journalism.
Yeah.
You know,
and think about the number of people you were going to be able to reach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Three columns a day. Benefits, great salary. It was wonderful, I thought, at first. And I took on the job. But what came with that job was this constant reminder that I wasn't good enough, that I needed to be checked and second-checked. And not just from the powers that be. The only editor I had that really got me was Dick Weiss. He really got me. But anyway, other than that, it was this constant churning in my stomach. Every day was a fight. They were looking for reasons to get rid of me. I had to go back and forth between the union. It was but silly charges. Finally, and I'll make this quick. I started to get this idea about starting a black nonprofit for kids to teach them entrepreneurs in their own communities. It came from this guy by the name of Muhammad Yunus. So I started working in that direction. And I went on a convention with my own money. And their charge was, I accepted an invitation from an organization that I did a story on, so therefore I should be fired. And at the same time, two columnists had accepted contracts from local TV stations. They just got a slap on the wrist. So, again, and there's another great thing about being in the community. They were working their way to fire me for, like, weeks and weeks. In the meantime, I called Percy. I called Eric Vickers. I called Earl Wilson. And I held a press conference. All my activist friends showed up. The community showed up. And I resigned. Before they announced I was being fired, I resigned. And I told them why I was being resigned.
I do believe that was at the Gateway Classic building. Yes, I was there.
And it was on television. It caught everybody by surprise.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And I think one of my lines was, you know, I'm not your boy.
Yeah,
you
know, I included that in my book. So, yes, I remember that line very well.
So, you know, I'm proud of that. That I was able to quit without them putting it out there that they were firing me. It was some BS. So then I started the Sweet Potato Project. Again, another struggle. You know, started in 2012, ended in 2020, but it wasn't my forte. The best thing I ever did in my life was to engage with those young people and show those young people and had them show me that they were capable and had the potential to not only be entrepreneurs, but to be business people, to do anything that they wanted to do if we gave them the resources to do it.
And the nurturing.
And the nurturing. Mm-hmm. And the resources again. So, it was the best thing I'd ever done, and I still regret that I wasn't business savvy enough. I was great with the kids, great with the lessons, but I didn't know the details of running a nonprofit.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother layer of BS.
And I was doing everything, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
From teaching the kids to picking them up to delivering cookies.
Yeah, I know all about that, yes.
Yeah. they grew sweet potatoes. Then they turned the product into, turned the produce into a product and sold the product.
Mm-hmm.
So it was amazing, but too much for me.
Yeah, yeah. Just a bit to go back to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, because I think the firing of you, because I don't know if that was the first major black reporter or black employee that they had fired. I think it was. It really did send some waves through the community for black folks who then started to look at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in a very different kind of way. Some people, terminated their subscriptions. But then it seemed like there was this whole thing about how they were going to look at the black community. And maybe your being there, that was an obstacle. But I just know that the way that they report, and sometimes it's not unintentional. I'll say that. I remember there was a case that we were working on, and they kept calling this person a rapist and a murderer. And so I said, maybe they don't know that Reggie Clemens was never charged or convicted of rape. So I sent a letter to the editor, and I said, I can, you know, share documents with you so that you all can clean up your journalism. And basically, they said they were going to proceed like they've been proceeding. So in other words, they were going to keep perpetuating the lie because that helped sell newspapers. So then I said, okay, I'm done with y'all because this is not journalism. And to your point about people like me and you not having the, quote, credentials to write, that's one of the reasons I never call myself a journalist. I call myself a freelance writer, a griot. But I know that for some people, those credentials are important, and they are important particularly for other black folks or other white folks who went through all of the, you know, the fire and brimstone to get that degree. And I don't know how what you do with that, because I think people can write, because they can write, and they can tell a story. And is that not what this is all about? But if people were looking at you with jaundiced eye thinking you took my job because I worked hard to be, you know, went to school at Columbia, in debt to be a journalist, yet I can't even get this job, and here's this guy out of, you know, the projects, and he gets this, you know, gravy job. What's up with that? So, those are some of the contradictions I just wanted people to hear about a journey of somebody that was trying to make contributions wherever they could. And I believe that the movement called you to do different things. Like where I started off, is not where I am now, and that's because I sort of bent to the callings of our movement wherever I was needed. But I know that it's not an easy journey. And then here you are, you are a fellow. I don't know if that particular position was created just for you, but it seems like it's a perfect fit. So talk about the Deaconess Community Fellowship.
If you don't mind, let me step back to something.
Okay. Sure.
The problem with the Post-Dispatch was I thought I could still be the same writer I was at Take Five.
Ah.
I was on Mayor Slade's butt.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the police officer's butts. You mentioned the Reggie Clemens case was one of the things we fought about. Another case was the Johnson, he recently got.
Oh, Lamar Johnson.
Not Lamar. Recently got executed.
Oh, yeah.
We called him Rocky Johnson. Kevin Johnson. I was the one that broke that story because they were saying at first that the officer that he killed was not on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
I was the one that had to go to fight the journalists who were saying he wasn't on the scene and fight the editors.
Exactly.
And say, I interviewed the family. They identified the police officer. This is like 17 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean the death threats.
Big Mac, that's what they called him,
yeah,
Big Mac.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. But some called him Lurch.
Yeah. Well, he has some other names too, but we can't say that on air.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I had to fight death threats from those stories I did on police mm-hmm. officers. But the real reason they got rid of me was the internet was really ending the a lot of newspapers. They knew that they had this red state readers. A lot of their money in advertising came from people who lived outside St. Louis.
Mm.
In fact, when they fired me, they had a silent campaign going out to different zip codes saying, we're not as liberal as you think.
Mm.
So they were trying to court mm-hmm. these conservative readers. And I was just in the way. You know, I was a guy who was causing a lot of unnecessary trouble at a time when money was fragile. So anyway.
But so to your point, then we know that the bottom line is the bottom line and not, you know, real journalism, real, you know, communication with readers. None of that really matters.
You can see that today.
Yeah.
If you look at any of the major network stations, a lot of the newspapers, money dictates everything. There would be no Fox News if there weren't those dollars coming from conservative circles. There would be no Donald Trump.
Right. Exactly.
Those red state readers and uninformed readers weren't voting and spending money to do that. So we are on a disastrous track
mm-hmm.
based on ad revenue.
Mm-hmm.
It's where dollars are going.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, getting back to what you were asking me about production.
The point that you made about readership and how you get courted, and then the folks who want to speak truth to power. When I started writing for the St. Louis American back in the early 90s, I was getting those kind of threats. And I was getting them from people, and at that time, no internet, so we were getting letters.
Right.
And these letters were unsigned. They were no return address. Mm-hmm. And I did a column that said, I try to be as polished and nice as I could be, but I said, you know, my face is on every week in this newspaper, and I am telling you how I feel. The least that you cowards could do is to put a name on your commentary.
Right.
I mean, these, I think the racist here is probably no different than anywhere else. It's some of the most cowardice people yes. I've seen. They will throw a rock and hide their hand.
Right.
And it's not just those, you know, the racist folks who are, you know, considered trailer park trash. Mm-hmm. These are folks that go up to the highest echelons. So, you know, I just said I got to keep going. Like I said, I never got censorship from the St. Louis American, and I think it's because I wasn't trying to perpetrate being a reporter. I'm not trying to be objective.
Right.
I'm trying to tell you what is really going on. And so people kept saying, why you keep writing about race, racism? Well, every time I leave my door, I'm reminded that I'm a black woman in America, so that's what I'm going to write about.
And, you know, you said that you're hesitant to call yourself a writer or a journalist.
Journalist. I am a writer, yeah. But not a journalist.
Journalist or writer, what are you going to call yourself? It's really about storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about getting stuff out of you. I personally cannot rest if something's going on in my mind. And so you can imagine I get very little rest nowadays.
Yes.
But you have to get it out of you.
Yes.
You have to put that truth out there in order for you to move on to the next thing.
But the other thing, Sylvester, that helps to push it out is that you also are in touch with other people who are feeling the angst, the repression, the anxiety, and you are absorbing that. So you also then are, their voices are all mixed up with you. It's like you're hearing all these voices in your head. You got to get it out.
And that's where I am today. And thank God. We'll talk about the fellowships I have. Thank God I have the fellowships to deal with issues that are not covered in the African American community that much. Because I know people. I know women who have reproductive rights and health issues, who are going to be harmed and impacted by this idea that you can't even get birth control. Or they're trying to... In the Missouri, rape and incest makes no difference.
No.
You still got to have a child.
So
all these things impact people that I know, you know.
Including your sisters.
Including my sisters. My sisters. Police brutality. You know, when I was with the kids at the Sweet Potato Project, when Michael Brown was killed, my students were the one that told me, called me, said, Mr. Brown, there's a boy laying outside the ground for more than 2 hours. My students were the one that told me how insulted they felt when the police showed up with guard, with dogs and guns, showed up at the scene.
Yep.
With guns. You know, the riot didn't start that night.
Right.
It was instigated that afternoon.
Right.
They showed up with guns and dogs. And so it was my students who translated to me the personal insult and harm and damage to their psyches of seeing people who are supposed to be of authority just trampling on their rights, and then portraying them as the perpetrators
as the criminals.
Right. So yeah. I mean, what you're saying was you're not just speaking for yourself. You're speaking for people in your community and people in your family.
And the people should know that's why it resonates, and that's why we could be considered dangerous because we are the messengers, but we're also amplifying our community voices, the pain and the triumphs.
Yeah. And going back to the American, as you know, we had many, many, many battles.
Yes, I do.
Take five in the American. Many, many battles.
Yeah.
I learned a lesson at this late age of humility from Dr. Donald Suggs. Because when I lost a job at the St. Post Dispatch, the American was the first ones that came out and defended me, tried to defend me, and attacked the Post Dispatch. It was Dr. Suggs who called me and said, not only did he support the Sweet Potato Project, when this opportunity came, when Deaconess came to Dr. Suggs and said, we're looking for a person to write about health issues that impact the community, it was Dr. Suggs and Chris King who suggested me, who came to me and said, we had this opportunity. So, and I asked Doc, I said, Doc, why weren't you petty? Why didn't you, I mean, you could have.
Yeah, he said, this is one of my competitors. I'm not doing nothing for him.
He said, Sylvester, no matter what we fought about or argued about, I always respected you as a journalist. And that meant the world to me. And it still does to me today. Here's this man.
And he'll say that to other people, not just to you. He said it to other people.
Okay. He's 91 years old. And he still makes room for me to speak through the St. Louis American. And of course, those fellowships help. Because I'm on my second fellowship now. First, I was the COVID reporter. Now I'm the community advocate, something like that.
Yeah.
Those fellowships help. I mean, you know, not only is it struggling for newspapers in general in America, it's doubly trouble for black newspapers.
Yeah.
So I admire everything that Doc does.
And I think we have to explain that sometimes to our black folks. It's like, why come my stuff didn't get in the American? Why come they didn't cover my event? I'm like, there's really nobody there to cover it. I mean, there's interns. I mean, so, you know, this is what citizen, you know, reporter and journalism is all about, unfortunately.
Yeah, the resources are limited there. But, you know, I think we do a yeoman's job.
Yeah. So being that advocate during that fellowship, you get a chance to write about a number of different things. What has struck you as a piece that you've written about that probably you wouldn't have ever written about had it not been for the fellowship or the ability to communicate with people in that way?
The first fellowship was on COVID-19. So to me, it was an opportunity to talk about this pandemic, this 100 year, didn't happen in 100 years, and how it impacted our people, you know, how they dealt with the grief, how they dealt with the fear. And the loss and the stupid, ridiculous conspiracy theories. So it was my opportunity to speak for them. And one story that stuck out to me was, I don't know if you remember, what's his name? He was a jewelry guy. He made jewelry. And he was kind of religious. And he swore, he and his partner, they were against vaccinations for religious reasons. And he died. He got the virus and passed away. Mm-hmm. So instead of telling that story in a, he should have done this kind of way, I told that story from his position and his wife's position. You know, they legitimately thought the virus was, wasn't going to help them. And so I was able to tell that story, but also tell what can happen, you know, the consequences mm-hmm. of those decisions mm-hmm. without being judgmental.
Right.
So the COVID gave me an insight into all sorts of issues and just how black folks were dealing with it. Mm-hmm. And some of it was very inspiring because it went back to who we were, mm-hmm. how we came to this mm-hmm. country and how we cope with mm-hmm. great sadness. So some of that was there. And the other part was tenacity. You know, there were black businesses that made it.
Right.
And black folks who made commitments to support black mm-hmm. businesses. Mm-hmm. You know, all that stuff was happening.
Yeah.
And now as a community advocate, I can touch on all sorts of issues. Like I said, the reproductive rights mm-hmm. issue. Was never well versed in that, didn't know all the details, but I had to teach myself, mm-hmm. learn about
do the research, yeah. talk with people, talk yeah. with women.
Mm-hmm. Talk to women mm-hmm. and find out, you know, this is not just a abortion issue, mm-hmm. this is a women's health issue.
Right.
And black women succumb from birth-related deaths more than white women.
The morbidity rate cuts across class. So I don't care what your income is.
Yeah.
You might be a middle class woman, but your baby is still, and you are still in peril.
Well, one Miss Merritt told me about Serena Williams. Was it Serena or Venus? Venus. Who was giving birth, and she had this problem creating some sort of cell. And she was telling the people, you know, I have this problem. And they were like, no, you just do this.
Oh, that was Serena.
Serena, mm-hmm. okay. Mm-hmm. And then what Ms. Merritt said was, here was a billionaire with the best health insurance mm. who the health community wouldn't even listen to.
Mm-hmm.
She said, so
just a black woman, what do you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? So mm-hmm. imagine there's nobody who doesn't have those resources or that fame in that position mm. and what the health community would have done to her. They would have ignored them. And ergo, this is why.
And that's why she's still alive.
Yeah. So anyway, just what I'm saying is these positions, these fellowships give me an opportunity to learn more about my people, and it reinforces that my journey into journalism. Mm-hmm. I got into this because of what I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I got into this because I wanted to swear that people would not be as ignorant as I was. So in a way, I'm still doing that.
Absolutely. I mean, we're lifelong learners. I mean, that's the way we come into the world. If you are just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. I am here with Sylvester Brown, and we are having an amazing conversation. And this might be a good time to say all the opinions expressed on this show are not those of Black Radio Hall of Fame or Harris Stowe State College. So, and both me and Sylvester have plenty of opinions, so don't mind us. So, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about a certain angst about stuff right now, and I've been telling people I've been feeling that, and I think the political climate is one that people are not paying attention to the way they should, and what could actually happen in this country. I mean, we're moving more, we're past the right, we're moving now towards authoritarianism and fascism.
Right.
And I don't know that the alarm has been sounded as loudly as it should. I know I've been writing about it, and I'm like, y'all, win, lose, or draw, whatever. If Trump doesn't get in, it's going to be some hell to pay.
Right.
So how are we prepared for that? And not just physically in terms of defending ourselves, but how are we going to defend this fragile thing called a democracy?
Right.
So what are you seeing out there in terms of the way that you know, the political climate is moving, the way the economy is moving. And then we got a presidential election coming up, and people's a certain venom towards Biden,
right.
By our people.
Right. Well, the reason I started the Sweet Potato Project teaching kids to be entrepreneurs in my own community, because I had this gut feeling, this gut belief that we will always be victims until we control our own, until we control our neighborhoods, control our schools, till we can put our kids, we can employ our kids like, you know, Asians do, or like Hispanics, like everybody. Until we create environments in our own communities that we control, we will always be victims.
Victims and asking other people for assistance, right, who have no interest in our in our reality and in our future.
Always seeking to go to the white schools and the white corporations, even though affirmative action and those things are changing. Anyway, I digress.
No, you're right on point.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I can go on. What scares me is I think we are asleep. If you look at January 6th, and the majority white, right, there might have been 12 black people there, majority white rioters, and how this country excuses, rewards, and exonerates white crime, you should be very disturbed. I'll tell you why. Because in 2019, Donald Trump, the Trump administration, was trying to pass a bill to designate black protesters as insurrectionists.
Right.
They were going to use the insurrectionist bill to immediately incarcerate black protesters. Based on
that would be me.
Well, no. Based on a few random acts of violence at these events. And you know, yeah, there was some.
And I'm saying that would be me because obviously at some point it's going to be expanded and loosely interpreted as who's a terrorist, right, who's an insurrectionist.
Right. Well, like in the days of Malcolm X and Mick Evers and people who were in charge of these organizations, who led these organizations, were targeted. Marcus Garvey were targeted and arrested.
Exactly.
So that's where they were before the insurrectionist thing happened in mid-January 6th insurrection. And I have no doubt that they will flip back on that if they had the opportunity. So this whole idea of fascism, as you mentioned, which, and I know I'm digressing again, but I just watched a PBS documentary called Nazi Town USA, where...
And would that be any town USA?
It was.
In the
1930s, before Hitler actually went buck wild and started invading everybody. And they had these little German... These are German-themed towns all across the country, including Missouri, where they proudly showed the Nazi flag, where they proudly preached fascism, where they proudly preached the separation of the races and attacks on Jews and African Americans, because they felt that America was already in that zone already. We were already segregated.
Yes.
We already hated Jews. Already hated blacks. Mm-hmm.
Prime.
Find that PBS documentary. It'll blow your mind, because the reason I brought that up is because they were using the same rhetoric they're using today, Christian nationalism, you know, love of flag pride, love pride, all the stuff that Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, all these things that we're talking now, they played this game back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. So it's just, to me, life is cyclical and it's dangerous, and I think way too many of us are asleep.
I agree, but how do we wake people up? Because so you talked about that one piece of legislation that, I don't know if he was trying to do that by, presidential whatever power, but those particular, bills have been introduced all across the country to criminalize protest. And so, some of us, even in Missouri, have been, for the last 4 years, have been beating back, these bills that are being introduced. This is, in some ways, this is going to be criminal. The latest one is that if there is any destruction of property, then the organizers of that event are going to be held accountable. Right. Now, how does one do that when you know you got provocateurs all over the place who will deliberately start some stuff, and now you're going to be accountable for a criminal? And this is going on all over the country. It passed in Florida. I had somebody on the show who was talking about that it definitely has put a chill on people, the protest. Right. I mean, that's what it's designed to do. If we can't protest injustices, you know, what kind of country is this? I mean, we no different than some of these other dictatorships, for real.
It goes back to you and I. You know, we've got to be the voices. No matter, even if nobody reads us. Not nobody, but it's the majority of the readers don't read our viewpoints and our stories. We got to keep putting it out there. Because sometimes something happens that resonates that makes our truth truth. Give you an example. And this is not just black folks. If you look across the country, there is a backlash against all this conservative crap. Tax on reproductive rights, the tax on banning books, all that stuff. I mean, yesterday, the school board in not Hazelwood, St. Charles area, where they were trying to remove the black curriculum.
Exactly.
Those school board members lost.
Mm-hmm.
So across the country, there's a backlash against all this nonsense, all the Marjorie Taylor Greene, all this silly, silly, petty culture war stuff. We cannot rest on that. We need to build on that. And I hate to sound kumbaya, but we have to build alliances with those people, not necessarily on the left, but even on the right, who feel like their rights are being assaulted. President Biden, if he doesn't blow it, has got the best chance, even a better chance in 2020 than he had in 2016, because it is clear that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. It is clear that these extreme right wingers are a threat to women's rights. It is clear that all kinds of rights that we take for granted are now under attack. Maybe not as clear as I like it to be. So, but what you saw in the 2020 supposed to have been the red wave, you know, mm-hmm. midterms. What you saw in 2022 and saw in 2023 is a backlash that I feel Republicans are self-destroying themselves with their foolishness.
Mm-hmm.
And I might be naive in that. I might be overly optimistic. But I do see pushback. And I think we need to encourage it, put it out there as much as we can, and hopefully have African Americans read it and come to the polls and act on it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't fall for the BS. They're now saying that 20% of African Americans are voting for Trump. That's a lie. If you look at, there's this group called Black Pack that done the research based on the exit polls. It was 12% in 2020, and it's 12% now.
Mm-hmm.
But they're trying to convince us.
Right, that it's growing. It's growing. A growing support for him. Yeah.
Now he's got his tennis shoes out now, so more black folks are going to vote for him.
Yeah, well, some of the Negroes are buying his tennis shoes.
A few. But I don't think anything like they want to pretend it is. Sometimes I even fault so-called liberal media for just taking the bait and falling
mm-hmm,
for it. I'm
going
to show a picture of a black guy with tennis shoes on. Didn't say 20% of them are voting for Trump. It's ridiculous and it's mind manipulation.
Yeah. But it reminds me, too, Sylvester, that it's so much noise out there. So much, it's not just confusion. It's downright inaccurate lies that are being perpetrated as if they're facts, as if they're news. And so what I've encouraged people to do is to find a trusted messenger. You could be me, it could be Sylvester, it could be, but folks don't have the time and the energy to be searching for where's the truth.
Right.
We have to do that.
Right.
And we do that. You know, when I don't understand something, I gotta go do some research, I gotta go find people who know more than me so that I can express to people what is this really about? It's a lot going on and I know our people are down, heads down in survival mode, but we have to continue, I think, as you said, to talk about what's happening in the political climate and what the stakes are for people of African descent.
Well, as much as I love the internet and social media, I recognize it's a huge societal downturn.
It is.
Because there's so much information.
It's so much.
And the vicious part about it is it validates any ignorant thought.
Yeah. I mean, it's not funny. It's not funny. It's pathetic. It's pitiful. It's sad.
Yeah. But if people see it on these news channels that unicorns are real, they believe it.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that Donald Trump is the second coming of Jesus
mm-hmm.
because somebody put it on a news-looking site.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really dangerous that so much information is available to so many unsophisticated people.
Right. You definitely have to have a critical lens to read this stuff. And sometimes it's best not to even read it because it's going to mess up your mind. You know, when you're talking about legislature that is harmful to democracy, and I'm thinking about there is a bill moving through our white-dominated, GOP-dominated state house to take local control back from the city of St. Louis. Now, this is going to be met, as I said in my column, with huge resistance because of the amount of effort and time that went into getting local control of our St. Louis Police Department. And now you have a few people who saying, I know y'all voted for that in 2015 by a majority, and it was not just black voters. These were voters who understood that what we had then was not working for us. The corruption of the deepest kind, or was crime, including crime by the police department and the police themselves. We are, you know, at a crossroads now because my thing is, okay, you all want to take back the city's police department, yet we're going to be paying the bills. That's not going to happen without a fight. So those raises and pensions and all of that stuff, be careful where you, how you're moving. So what is your take? Because you had a chance to interview police chief recently, and you wrote about that in the St. Louis column. Part of that was kind of disturbed about some of his comments.
Yeah.
So, for example, one of the things he said was, you know, this 2018 audit that had all this negative stuff, and he claimed he did not have the power or authority to push that audit so that it became public. And so this is one of the things that people have been saying, the transparency of the police department is null and void, and we've been asking for it, and not just black activists, you know, people in general, you know, news organs have been asking for it, and they just have refused to budge. And so when you say I can't make something public that should be public, I'm thinking, well, what happened to your commitment to transparency?
Yeah, when he was in Chicago, he made that commitment to transparency.
Yes.
A couple of things. One of them is, we have to be very aware of what's going on in Jefferson City.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us let Jefferson City legislators kick former Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner out of office.
Right.
On some bogus, made-up legislation. Not to say she didn't have her, you know, faults. But the way they got rid of her was strictly power. Mm-hmm. How dare you, black woman, charge our Governor Greitens for a crime?
Mm-hmm.
How dare you go after the police department? How dare you put 28 police officers
on a list
mm-hmm. that they can't be? So a lot of it was just power.
Mm-hmm.
That power is still in play.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that power in Jefferson City, I mean, St. Louis, Kansas City, we are liberal bastions in a great big red,
mm-hmm.
deep red state. So we're going to always have to fight them legislatively.
Mm.
Always have to fight them with knowledge.
Mm.
When it comes to the police chief, the bottom line is that Mayor Tashara Jones brought him on. And I know she did so because of his alternative policing methods. But we have to let her know that, okay, you brought him on. But as of now, you're his boss.
Mm-hmm.
As of now, we want transparency. As of now, we want you to hold him accountable. I did my best in that interview, and you're right. There's some things I let him get away with because I didn't have the backup to really argue with
mm-hmm.
him.
And some of this, you just need to get it out there so people like me can talk about it.
One of my questions was inspired by you, if you recall.
Yes.
Because you asked me about
the tape.
Non-VPA tapes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm glad you did, because mm-hmm. I did ask him about that.
And I knew that he would give that pat answer. Are we still under an investigation?
But he did say it's coming soon.
Yeah, he did say that. He's been saying that for a while. And here we're almost on 2 years of the anniversary of that shooting at Visual and Performing Arts. And this whole notion about it may traumatize people again.
Re-traumatize.
Okay, there are police departments that released it sometimes, some of them within 6 hours of the shooting, because they wanted people to see what had happened, and that you start immediately to begin to plan out the next time this happens so that you don't do the same mistakes. So now we're 2 years Right. Almost 2 years out, we don't know what mistakes were made by the police. We know that young man was killed. Okay, that might be a good thing. I don't, you know, I try not to think about that piece of it. But we don't know what security measures were breached, what how it could have been done differently, how it could have been done better. We don't know that. And so now, because we are a nation that has short memories, now we moved on to other stuff. So yes, now it could be re-traumatizing, because had it been done sooner, that would have been all part of the healing process.
Right. Right.
And we would have been part of a process that says this is never going to happen again in any of our schools.
Right.
But now it's like still this whole thing. And I think for me, the one reason I kept pushing for the tapes to be released is because we were hearing from students that there was a white shooter.
You told me that. Yeah.
And so I said, well, let's look at the tape and see if there were any other shooters and what could have happened. We also know that the family of the shooter tried desperately to get him some help for a while, including remove his weapons that he had. And he had quite a little arsenal.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. The same people that are fighting for local control have made it easy for folks to get a hold of semi-automatic weapons.
Right.
So people need to know that. Like, these folks ain't for all our, you know, safety in our community. Forget that. And so when the chief says that something started to happen between police and the community, based on the George Floyd, I'm like, whoa, you are so out of touch.
Mm-hmm.
Then he says the community and the police are one. And we need to work together. Now, come on, you living in some kind of la-la land, because that is not the reality. And if you believe it is, then the strategy that you're going to have to do policing in our community is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much animosity towards police. That's why they cannot recruit black officers, because you have made that profession such a despicable one.
Mm-hmm.
That folks don't even want to be a part of it. And that includes all the benefits that come with that.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you telling me, that we are a community of one? No, we are not.
I heard it as more of a projection or a goal as opposed to a fact. You know, I heard it as him saying this is what we're working toward. So, you know, okay, you got that, fine. But, yeah, I did find him to be surprisingly candid. He didn't really bucket anything that I asked him. He answered in his own way, but he answered the questions. To me, the important thing was to ask the questions,
mm-hmm,
and get his response in writing. And then hopefully the community, like you,
mm-hmm,
will read his response and go back and say, okay, you said this.
Mm-hmm.
How about this?
Mm-hmm.
This. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing, though, Sylvester. You must have some kind of magic, because the other media, white media, mainstream media, have been trying to get interviews with him for since he arrived on the scene, and he's been avoiding them. So how did you manage to get that exclusive interview with the chief?
Actually, I was kind of put out, because I read smaller interviews. He did one to Riverfront Times, but they were all kind of like puff pieces.
Yes.
He didn't want to Riverfront Times, didn't want the Post-Dispatch, but they were all smaller in size. And so I wasn't impressed that he gave an interview. I was impressed it took him so long, too, because this was about a month in the making to get him tied down to a one-on-one interview with him. So, yeah, I mean, you know, just had to stay on him because, I like talking to the police.
Well, you know, Channel 4 has, like, you know, tried to use the Sunshine Law to get certain information, and they're not getting it. And so the police department, I think of all of the city departments, has historically not participated with the law, the Sunshine Law.
Right.
I mean, here's somebody that's supposed to be supporting and enforcing law, but then they are, you know, looked at as lawless. So I think we...
other departments within the police, you know, that's the legal unit. And that's, you know.
Yeah. I think they got a lot of work to do, and the fact that he came into office subsidized by the police foundation is already problematic. And so, it would be like, for example, this man's got $100,000 being paid on top of his salary that the U.S. That the city has been able to give him. And I liken it to, if that was a black candidate that was left standing and there was a little bit of balking, and the Organization for Black Struggle said, we're going to give him $100,000 to supplement that salary, I think people would stop that the negotiation cold. Stop it.
You would think so. I mean,
right where it is, like, oh, that's going to mean that OBS and black folks are going to have control over him, and he's going to be at their beck and call. Well, that's exactly how we feel about the white police foundation giving that money, because now we believe he's beholden to them. So I just tell people, put it in the reverse. If it was black money, what would people be saying?
And you can't blame, I mean, I work for the St. Louis American, but my fellowship is paid for by the Deaconess Foundation. So you can bet your bottom dollar, I'm going to make sure the Deaconess Foundation is satisfied so they can re-up that fellowship.
Exactly.
So it's not only just the nonprofit that pays his salary. Then you got a whole different private policing entity.
Yeah, you know, you touched on that in the article.
That these officers moonlight on, you know, mm-hmm. to protect certain neighborhoods. The Grove, downtown, some mm-hmm. other areas. And I like, how can this not be a pay-for-play situation? Of course, he said what he said. But
here's the other thing with that, Sylvester. There's also these little entities that are looking like police. They got the little car saying the finest. Yeah. And so I remember in a meeting that the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression was having, we asked the question of, I can't remember what city official was there. We said, well, what about these wannabe cops, these like little security, because we were talking about complaints. Like if people had a complaint against them, some of them are not bona fide police officers. What do you do with those complaints? And so it's a gray area that really hasn't been touched. But you know, these people like will stop you. They will. Do we have to respond to the directives if they, you know, play cops?
Right. Can they pull me over?
Yeah. Can they even pull me over? So I mean, it's just like this police state that's growing, and we don't know what all of this means. But and we're trying to ask the question, but we're not getting any answers.
I would love to see. Mayor Tashara Jones is taking $150 million of this COVID money and investing it in the African-American community, North St. Louis.
Right.
I would love to see a black security company, you know, run by maybe a former black officer in North St. Louis. See how that operates. See what kind of pushback that would get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had a black private entity hiring off-duty black cops to protect black North St. Louis.
Mm.
I would love to see her do that.
But here's the thing. I think there could be the opportunity to do that because it's RFP, so somebody could actually apply to say, here's what I'm going
to
do,
right.
And it's going to look differently. I think people, black folks, have been over-policed. This thing about we need more police, that has shown to be ineffective and not good. Because we're already in the top of the list for cities that have more police per capita than any other city of our size. And not only that, the police kill more people. So why is the solution going to be more police? And so that's what I think our communities are resisting. They're resisting the fact that they can't get any service. They don't come when they called. I mean, you know, and it's not just this whole thing like we understaff, because one of the things that I was hearing from people inside who listening to the chatter is that basically the police have been on a stealth strike since the Mike Brown shooting, when they then say, let Black Lives Matter come to you when you got a call, since you all think the police is all that. So it's like this sort of protest that's going on, and many of them say, I'm going to do what I need to do until I retire, but I'm not going out of my way. And so some of these calls that people should be hearing from police when they call, they're not getting in. In fact, sometimes the police never come. So if we were in a job situation, those folks would be fired, right? If you didn't show up for your work, you'd be fired. So, you know, some other things are going to have to happen. And the whole re-envisioning public safety is one that does not center police. It centers services. It centers community involvement. And so I just think that that's played out, because now we see that there is a drop in crime. There's a drop in juvenile crime. And that's not been about the police. That's been about organizations who've been working together to try to re-envision public safety.
Right. The only missing component is economic, the ability to give their own kids jobs in the community right now while they're kids, and to control where they go to school and where they work. You know, that's the only missing element. I hope we come around to it.
Yeah, it's so much that we need, but I think, Sylvester, our communities have so much asset, so much strength that that's getting buried, and we have to find ways to lift that up. Thank you for joining me, Sylvester Brown. We got to do this again.
Absolutely.
Next week, we're going to be talking about you folks that don't want to do wills and you let yourself die and everybody's fighting over your little pieces of property. If you missed any of these episodes, you can see them on JamalaRogers.com. But yeah, stay safe out there, you all. This is Jamala Rogers. Thank you for listening. I'll see you on the battlefield.
We don't need